Before we start the Meet the Leader podcast, I'd like to let you know that in this episode, there is mention of a suicide. So please bear in mind before giving this a listen and do so with care. Thank you. So thank you for joining this podcast of Meet the Leader. And quite a few of you, if you've listened to the leaders in the past, will know that it's a role that I think is not known about, understood, or truly appreciated. And unique people do amazing things as leaders of local authorities. Now, up to now, I've tried to stay away from those that I really know, the people that I enjoy hanging out with and people that I have a soft spot for. And as fate would have it, that plan of leaving those people that I know the best to a little bit later in this series has fallen apart. And I have called upon someone that I know well. A few years ago, a friend of mine said to me, "You should meet the new leader of Barking and Dagenham. He's your kind of person." I said, "What do you mean he's my kind of person?" "You'll know when you meet him." We were in the south of France in Mippim, and I went up to a very modest stand, and there, rummaging around in the storage cupboard at the bottom of the stand, was a gentleman that has been a great force in my life, actually, a great friend, a great advisor. And he stood up and he said, "Welcome to the smallest stand with the largest opportunity in London. So Darren Rodwell, thank you for joining me."
Well, that's just ruined my whole political career. People know we're friends now. How
are you doing? Well, we've got to admit it. But Darren, we're talking plenty of time about what you've done since becoming the leader. But I really want to look at before, and I know that some of the political strifes of the borough have been really informative about who you are. But you are from Barking and Dagenham, aren't you?
I am. I'm born and bred. I was born in Barking Hospital, up in the hospital, like most of the great people of the world are. And I grew up in Dagenham Village, had my teenage years in Chadwell Heath, and then moved back to Dagenham when I became a single parent. So I am truly borough born and bred.
And we'll talk about how that goes through everything that you do. But your life before being a councillor, what was that about? What sort of journey have you had on that front?
So it's really interesting because I had a life before being a councillor. You don't get one after you've become a leader of a council, that's for sure. It's 24/7, full on. But it's been one that's led me to this space to be able to bring the opportunities that my community now have. And that's because actually my life story, like many people's life stories, has been full of different moments, some good, some bad, some aspirational, some very sad. And it allows me to show the empathy that needs to happen when I believe you serve. Because that's the ultimate thing about, as you know, I will never say I'm a politician. I will say I'm a community champion because I champion my community. Because actually, what I've seen in modern day politics is people see themselves above the people they are meant to serve. And I've never seen myself in that space. I'm no more important than the person who sweeps the streets. And that came from the fact that you can tell I've got the dialect of a blue-collar estuary man, which I'm very proud about. But it shows you the background I've come from. Not very good at school. Our schools were not very good. I'm dyslexic. I wasn't recognised. And I had the whole sort of Blue Peter catalogue of punishments, the cane, the slipper, you name it, I had it many times, because the system didn't understand free thinkers like I've always been lucky enough to see. And that's what really, in the end, brought me to politics, was when the darkest moment of the borough's history was the far right becoming the official opposition. And actually, if they had seen the real support they had, they could have taken the council. And I gave up everything I was doing before, and even up to today, since my life, to make sure that my community had a future that once again we could be proud of, as we was 100 years ago when Henry Ford and the Becontree Estate was being built.
And it's interesting about the Becontree Estate, because that's a a very important part of the borough for you, I know, and you've driven me around it and about regeneration and house types and construction materials. It was a very important estate for what has gone on right across Greater London.
Well, and the country, Nick. Remember, the housing here was remodeled across the whole country. It's the largest single estate the UK's ever built, of all the infrastructure. And they managed to build 27,000 homes, all the infrastructure, the parks, the doctor's surgeries, the schools, the libraries, all the shops. The 15-minute city was the notion at that time here in Barking and Dagenham. And they did that with steam trains and horse and car. And that's why I get quite cross when I see the complete failure of the housing market today in being able to deliver the homes that many Londoners and people across the country need.
So for me, Barking and Dagenham, there's obviously the connection to the Ford Motor Plant. And for me, that's my earliest awareness of this part of London stroke Essex, is that manufacturing heartland of the Henry Ford Empire. Massive involvement in my life, funny enough, in the cars that my father drove. But my awareness of Barking and Dagenham really has only come alive in the last 8 or 9 years. What's been the sort of lead up to your time in politics? How has the borough evolved through the industrial era and the sort of the era of the car factory, and then the loss of the car factory and the changes that were brought on by that? How's the borough sort of been? Because I don't really know enough about that side of it.
So that's what's really interesting. So whilst I've had a very poor education from the state, I actually had a very good education from my community. That allowed me to understand people and place and how actually people can be taken advantage of by others who are there just to make money. So that's why we've had quite a big emphasis of making sure that we have inclusive growth in Barking and Dagenham. And that comes back to, if you like, Henry Ford. Now, people that know the history of the place will know that Barking, before the Beckentry Estate was built, was classed as highly as places like Chertsey. And in fact, the Eastbury Manor House was known as the Hampton Court of the East. It was so admired. And what happened was this very middle class, upper middle class at the time, town that had just come part of London in 1931, had this big housing estate being built next door. And it's really interesting that when you look at the borough and the Beckentry, there's actually parks and a cemetery splitting it from what was the old town of Barking. When I say old town, these were still 1930s properties as well, but it was middle class. And that brought a big rivalry between the two areas, because you had a very proud working class, uneducated by and large community, but hardworking and, you know, articulate, knew their culture and proud of that culture, versus a very different long-standing culture of an Essex town, as you say, at the time. And that rivalry continued all the way through into my lifetime. And I remember when the formulation of the boroughs were done in 65, before I was born, we were known as the London Borough of Barking until 1980. So I was 10 years old when the word Dagenham was reintroduced. Because the people of Dagenham said, well, hold on a minute, we're just as important as those people over there. They might be of a different, you know, affluence to us, but actually we're the people that build your cars. We're the people that make the drugs that you need, the machine guns in the Second World War. We're the people, we are the manufacturing heartbeat of the east of London. And actually the borough has the highest brownfield site of any London borough. So, you know, there's a lot of pride there. And if you know your history, if you know where you come from, you know what you stand for. And if you know what you stand for, you know what you fight for. And if you know what you fight for, you know you can change the world. Remember, it's the women of Dagenham Falls, supported by the women of Howard, that got the Equal Pay Act in 85. You know, they went against Thatcher and said, it's not good enough, government. if you're not going to give it to us, we're going to go to a higher pool because we have the rights to be recognised for the talents we have. And that's on the back of what I have learned from my community, that I don't care who you are, who you think you are. I don't care how much money you've got. At the end of the day, what you can't be is people in place. And that's what we've done in Barclay and Dagenham over this last, well, just short of a decade. We've shown that from the ashes of deindustrialization, of poor policy over decades, that actually you can have a rebirth of investment, both in housing and the homes that need to be built, but also in industry. So, you know, we're looking at media, data science, engineering, logistics. Many people laugh at me, but I talk about the train that comes into Barking from Asia, from China. And, you know, by the end of this decade, we will have a train line that will be able to get you from Barking to Beijing in under 36 hours, or the whole of Europe, the whole of Asia, and the whole of Africa. 80% of the world's economies will be here on this line. No different to what happened when we had the fishing fleet for the country for a good few hundred years. And that's what we know we are about. And we will always carry on striving. The young people of Barking and Dagenham do tremendously well when you see the challenges they have, through the fact that the ONS itself shows we're the most deprived area in the country. But, you know, 96% of my schools are good to outstanding. That's because the young people know where they are today. They know the poverty they live in today, but they aspire for a much brighter future for tomorrow. And that's what we try and encourage.
So, and I think that you do so in style. Let me get you to think about the time that you became the leader.
Yep.
You had I had dealings with the council then. You had officers who, there was a very good officer corps at the time, but there was a sense of, you'd go to Barking and Dagenham, go back in another year and you'd have the same conversation. There wasn't a drive, a momentum behind it to deliver. Yet we're now dealing with something that's incredibly dynamic. Almost you're in the market saying, come this way. How have you transformed it? What did you have to do? What were the things that you had to do to get the council moving in the direction that we now see it today? And how hard was that?
So I can give you the nice story. I can give you the Dagenham story. So basically, I've always had a belief that no one should ever stand in anyone else's way. So I've always been a facilitator of change. I've done that in my own life. I've never chosen where people should end up. For my children, I've never chosen their religion. That's for them to choose. It's not for me to make that decision. What I can do, and the only thing I can do, is give choices. Now, when I came into this organisation, obviously I'd known about the organisation from doing community work for a number of years. And I knew that the elected members then didn't connect with the community. They didn't talk in any large degree. So actually, as an institution, we had no grounding to the location of the people we were trying to serve. So I had to, first of all, before I even became a councillor, make the biggest sort of campaign of communication that had ever happened in the borough's history. When we were fighting the BNP, we knocked 168,000 doors. We spoke to over 60,000 people in those last few years before 2010. Because first of all, we had to apologise. We had to apologise that we'd let them down. We were in a new Labour government, the end of a new Labour government. And even though that government had done a lot of good things, schooling, health, there was too many things that we hadn't done that mattered to, you know, the working class blue collar communities that I live amongst. And they told us so. And first of all, it was an apology. We listened. And then we saw a common theme about aspiration. So it doesn't matter if it's someone on benefits or someone who wants to be the next chief exec of a big corporation. Everyone has aspiration. So it's how do you facilitate that aspiration? What is the different elements that make people believe that that change is there and gives them hope for the future? And that's what we started to pull together politically. And then when the leadership happened, and I, with my colleagues, became the leadership, it's fair to say that we had quite a churn of senior management, not because they weren't good people, but because it wasn't set up in a way that would bring that dynamic change that we needed to bring a new urgency, a new direction, a new aspiration to the place. And when we first met, I went to MIPIN that first year, and my rhetoric was the smallest stand with the largest opportunity, because it wasn't just about the housing we could build, it was about the aspiration that we could bring forward. So I needed, and if you remember at that time, that first year, I also did the first ever post-MIPIN
You
event.
did,
Now everyone else follows that. Well, that's because I'm entrepreneurial. And I often say that if you're rich enough to have an ideology, you're not working class. Because in my world, I've always had to find a way of surviving. And I'm proud of that, because that gave us a very different insight on how to deliver things. And we realigned the council to be a facilitator of the ambition that this community had, whilst at the same time finding partners that would invest in that ambition. And not many people know this, but that week, I lost a cousin who was more like a brother to me. He hung himself. And the last time I'd spoken to him, it was over a family matter where we disagreed. And I kept meaning to phone him, and I never did. And it's not many things I regret in life, but I regret that, because I was too busy trying to support my community. And it taught me a lesson that I can't forget my family. And so I try as best as I can to make sure that I get a balance. Whilst I still work far too many hours, I have to remember that I have a great family, both wife, children, grandchildren, but also an extended family that are proud of me and I am of them, no matter what jobs we do. And that keeps you very grounded, and but you know what you're fighting for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know your family and they are proud as punch. But I also know that you're a very wise man. And when Mrs. Rodwell tells you to do something, I know that you listen. So I think that's very wise for your future.
I often say, mate, I lead the council, I don't lead indoors.
But one of the things that was interesting was you took, I want to use my words carefully, I think a forgotten part of London.
Yeah.
And you won the support. I can't think of any developer who you've not had in your borough investing. And there's a perception of developers, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly, that they're there to make their money and get back on the train. How did you sort of balance? How did you pitch these people? What was the story? It's not just that there was tons of opportunity in Barking Dagenham, and there is and there was. But how did you explain your expectations of what they could come and do? I remember a bit of a conversation, but how did you take the next step? You got people on the hook. They said, "Okay, Darren, you've got something going in Barking and Dagenham." How did you lay down the law? What was the speech?
It's really interesting. So one of my early days, I used to say I took on the BNP, I took the house tax, the death threats, not to give it away to the private sector. So if you want to do business, this is how we're going to do business. I respect you've got to make money, but I've got to make a community. So when you're ready to have that adult conversation, let's see what we can do together.
That is exactly the speech I remember you giving. And
So
how did that land and how has that evolved? Because, you said to me, I think, I'll define some of my success by the number of cranes I get up. And funny enough, I was with Abby Brown, who you know, up in Stoke-on-Trent, and she's very proud of two cranes that she has currently standing. It is
Well, that's better than I've got
a
28 and I'm disappointed.
signifier. But how's that evolve, that relationship, and Do you
So you've
think?
got to understand, what does business want? They want continuity, they want certainty, yeah, and they want to make money. And what business needs to understand, I remember having this conversation, I've had many people come through the door, you know, some of them saying, I can give you billions of pounds. But if they're not talking about my community and the aspiration of my community, then actually they're not talking my language. And I'm very clear about that. And you know that I am quite entrepreneurial. As people say to me quite often, the left thing come right and the right thing come wrong. What do I actually do? Well, what I do is I look at a problem and say, right, how do I find a solution that will give the best outcome to as many people as possible? And that's why we set up companies. Many other councils have followed suit since and failed. But we have been seen as the best example in public-private partnership by SIFPA and others. And, you know, it's paid dividends. So BeFirst, which is a wholly owned council company, but it's got a private board with private officers, allowed us to invest in that area of planning that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to do with the, you know, the cuts that have come from the national government. So we were able to take, if you like, a very forgotten place. We didn't know whether we were in Essex or whether we were in London. Our planning department was no different to any other planning department. It suffered major cuts. Developers looked at land values and the fact, you know, most of the land was industrial, so it had some very poor use over years and was very dirty. So there was lots of issues, but ultimately it comes back to the basics of certainty. And that's what people want to know. So if you look at us as a borough, we're now the number one planning authority in the country. If you use BeFirst, which is, you know, a company that is framed by the policies of the councillors that lead the council. So if we know something's coming forward by BeFirst, we know that they are going to work within the framework that we've set, which is within the planning, the local plan that we want to put through, the London plan, but also what we want to see that we have developed as elected members for the place. So, you know, we find that in the last, I think it's 2.5 years, we've put through nearly 10,000 homes for planning permission. As a council, we've used our company to build over 2,000 homes with our partners that are truly affordable. In fact, for London, we have built 20% of London's affordable housing since COVID, which is quite phenomenal when you think there's three authorities. So it's about saying, what is the problem and where is the solution to that problem? And, you know, sometimes there are some bits where I go, I don't quite like that. It doesn't quite go with what I feel is right. If I can see by the data, if I can see by the aspiration of the place that it's the right thing for the place, then I'm not going to say no. And probably the best example of that was the Freepool. You know, I want British business to do well because that means it's more jobs for residents in my borough due to the deprivation and, you know, deindustrialisation. I saw what happened when Ford's closed. We were a mining town in the north that basically imploded. And that's how the BNP managed to do as well as they did. I don't want that to happen again. So I want to make sure everyone has the best opportunities. And, you know, the Freepool, I remember having conversations with people in my party where they were saying, oh, this isn't right. This isn't the right ideology. And I agree. But my argument back was, well, can you give me £2.5 billion and 21,000 jobs? If you can do that, with that ideology, I'll go with you. If you can't do that, this is the only thing on the table that literally will put food in people's mouths. And that's what matters to me most, is making sure that that child believes they have a future and they have, as a family, hope that things will change for the better. And that's proven to work here. You know, we've had the highest demographic change anywhere in the country. We've got the highest population of young people, 57,800 odd young people. We've built two new schools every year for the last 10 years, the equivalent of. We've got the highest first choice places in London regularly. So, you know, our TA has dropped year on year for the last 6 years. 900 families on our waiting list have managed to go into housing. That's what matters. Yeah. So when people say to me, has it worked? I can show them all the challenges, but I can show them all the opportunities that have come from the investment that we've managed to achieve. And politically, our residents have responded. So we've had the highest proportion of vote of any party in London twice. In 2018, it was 76.7%. In 2022, it was 79.6%. So that shows that it's their vision that I'm pushing.
Yeah, absolutely. The two questions
Go
to
on.
sort of wrap this up for now, because we could talk, as we do always, forever about things
You're
about
trying to
the.
ruin my career again there, Nick. I
No,
always
no,
said it
no, sorry, we don't
sports
talk at all. This is an absolute vicious rumor. Darren and I never talk.
guy.
But the two things.
Yep.
Darren Rodwell's not the leader. Does it carry on? Have you created the vision that will follow on onwards? Because there are examples of where great leaders have been there, but no one has been able to follow up. And the
I think
other
I went
issue is
on.
when you we talked about the family life, and you've got an eye on that. You never take that for granted. The personal cost of leadership. You're doing dinners. You're going to events. You're on the go all the time. Very often we'll exchange messages at ridiculous times of the day when you're off on a train to go to a breakfast meeting to sell your borough. That personal cost to you in serving your community, is it greater than you ever imagined? And what would you say to someone else who's taking on being the leader of where they have grown up?
Okay, so first of all, I would say you made the mistake of saying I'm the leader. I'm not, I'm the facilitator. Okay, I facilitate other people's ambition. So, whilst I may have the mouthpiece, whilst I have my own style, everything that I have articulated has been done through a whole collection of conversations and listening exercises. As I said before, I don't see myself as a politician, I see myself as a community champion. I serve my community. Now, I mean that absolutely. I knew that from the first day I started the role, which by the way is the best role I'll ever have in my life, to make a change for the future of this borough, I knew I was a day closer to finishing that role. And tomorrow I could be sweeping the streets again. I don't know. I've never ever planned for being anything more than the person that's the same as the person next to them. And when you are at that space, when you believe you are no better and no worse than anyone else, it doesn't matter what the future brings. As long as I've got food in my stomach, clothes on my back, and a home that I can support my family with, then everything was really irrelevant to me. It doesn't matter. Status has no bearing to me whatsoever. For anyone who's ever going to get into this, what I would say to them, being that I've done this nearly for 10 years, is if your heart isn't in it, then don't do it. Because the cost to you and your family is immense. And I don't mean that in any very, sort of ideology way. It's the amount of abuse the public figures take at a local level, and it doesn't get recognised. You get no support from the organisation because you're not employed by them. You don't get support, particularly by your party, because what can they actually do? The law's not there for you to be protected either, unless it gets extreme. And when I say extreme, that's like death threats and stuff like that, which, if I'm being honest, I'm going to Crown Court in October for one of my latest ones. The house got attacked. The abuse my children and my grandchildren have come under. It is a lot. So your heart has got to be in this. You don't do it for the money, and you shouldn't do it for the acclaim, because I can tell you it's one of those where One minute you're up, the next minute you could be flat on your back. So what you've got to do is just dust yourself off and go, that was a good ride. So whatever happens in the future, I wish all those leaders all the best. But remember, in my opinion, you're there to serve as well as lead, because the best leadership facilitates others.
I think that's the perfect end of this broadcast. Darren, thank you. And
Thank you very
for.
much. I'm glad I was able to be a step in for you as the
No,
little
I'll
platform.
behave. But, one of the things I would say to just finish this off, leadership is just what Darren just said. And people who are standing for elections in the future, that's what it's all about. So thank you, Darren Rodwell. And thank you for listening.